Today is June 21st, and it's official now. Now we can say it's the first day of summer. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original Personal Computer Radio Show, the original radio program on all things personal computing. I'm Hank Key, and in the studio with me is Joe King. We are heard each Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, on the Internet at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Our website is pcradioshow.org. Our broadcasts are available for downloading from prn.fm, wbai.org, and our website, pcradioshow.org. When WBAI is fundraising, we may be preempted by a replacement program, but we continue with a regularly scheduled weekly program on prn.fm.
Well, Hank, you know, on July 12th of this year, we're going to be going on the air with a one-hour special, not our regular computer radio show. It was special with Dr. Alfred Poor and Dan Rosenbaum. He's the publisher of Health Insider. I'd like to say that that special is going to be on the convergence of technology and health matters, and it's really vitally important for everybody to watch because we all know somebody who has a problem, and a lot of them are going to be solved in the near future. But I'd like to make note that on that same day, July 12th, but a few years before, July 12th, 1957, the Surgeon General announced that cigarette smoking could kill you. Now, I wish Hanky had said it a few years earlier. I could have saved myself a lot of grief.
Well, you know, 60 years ago, if they had e-cigarettes, you could have been smoking e-cigarettes, which is supposedly safer than cigarettes.
The jury isn't really in on that. But I got a question for you, Hank. If I smoke an e-cigarette, can I get the virus?
Well, you may not be able to get the virus or can get the virus, but there was a researcher that done some work on it and found that with e-cigarettes, the way you recharge it is you have to, you have to plug it into a wall and get it recharged. But some of the e-cigarettes have the ability to where you could go into a regular USB port on a laptop or a desktop machine and charge up the e-cigarette. And guess what? If you do it, you can introduce malware into your system.
If somebody has first introduced the malware into the cigarette.
And believe me, with all that stuff coming in from overseas,
Forget it, Hank. Now that you've mentioned it on the air, every bad news black hat hacker out there is going to do that.
Well, what I'm saying is, look, I understand why some people are using e-cigarettes because it doesn't have the nicotine. Although,
No, it has the nicotine.
I can't even pronounce the word aerosolarized.
It has aerosolarized nicotine. It doesn't have the tars. It has the drug, nicotine.
So it's still there.
The nicotine is there, and it's a habituating drug. And I don't think it's a Class A drug, but it is a habituating drug. And I know because for many years I had the habit.
Well, some places won't allow e-cigarettes to be used, even though you say it's not a cigarette.
Well, there has been very, very little research on it. We know how damaging secondhand smoke can be to people who are not smoking.
Well, a researcher, what he has done, and actually he gave a demo on it, he made a presentation, where if you can plug in an e-cigarette to recharge the unit, because it does recharge, it does need recharging, and you can introduce malware not into the e-cigarette, but the e-cigarette actually can transmit the malware into your system because it can have an autoplay, and the autoplay could be any command you want. It could wipe out your disk if you want. So it can be done, and that's one reason why Microsoft has eliminated the autoplay command on all installation of programs.
Well, I noticed there was no autoplay on my Windows 10 machine, and there's no autoplay on my Windows 10 laptop, but there still is an autoplay on my Windows 7 laptop.
Well, that's why they asked you to move on to 10.
Yes, but there's no warning that went out that to me from my manufacturer of the laptop that I should not charge a cigarette from there.
Well, I thought you gave up smoking. Why do you concern so much about e-cigarettes now if you gave up smoking?
Because I'm a little bit different from you and other people. There are other people out in the world, and I'm concerned about them.
Well, I think the best advice we can give people is if you have to use e-cigarettes for whatever the reasons are, charge it up through the wall outlet. Don't go through a USB port.
And don't smoke in the same room with others.
And the best solution is give it up altogether. Hey, by the way, did you ever use a patch? Does that work?
I use a patch right now, but not having nothing to do with cigarettes.
Okay. Because I think you finally gave up cigarette smoking because the doctor said it's good for you to give up smoking?
No. Hank and I had a very dear friend who very sadly got terminally ill with cancer, and his wife was as heavier smoker as I was and kept putting off not smoking until two or three days before he was to come home from the hospital, and she called me and she said, I'm going to try something. I don't know, but I cannot smoke in front of Steve. I'm not allowed to smoke in front of him. I'm going to go get myself hypnotized. So she went to a hypnotist who specializes in no smoking, and a week later she called me and said, it worked. I haven't smoked in a week. I haven't felt I needed it. And I was up there the next weekend getting myself and my wife hypnotized, and it worked for me. Not for my wife, because you really have to want to stop smoking. And then the hypnosis works.
And, you know, too bad that when you were in the service, they gave out free cigarettes because the tobacco companies knew what they were doing. And, of course, you said, free cigarettes, look what I got.
Well, I started smoking long before I was in the service. But when I was in the service, our K-ration kit came with smokes. But also, we could go into the, what do they call that post store? The PX.
PX.
We could go into the PX and buy a carton of cigarettes. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
A carton, not a pack, for $1.70.
Oh, because I remember in those days, it cost me $1.75 to buy a whole carton.
No, the reason it was so low when
no, mine was only a nickel more.
Well, yours was a nickel more. What they did in the PX is they waived all federal and state tax. So the cost of a cigarette was the cost of a cigarette. Today, cigarettes cost, $8, $10 a pack.
I think it's more than that.
Whatever. But that's the cost of the cigarette. Still, probably around 2 or 3 cents a cigarette. The rest is tax.
Well, the best thing that ever happened to me was that, when you go to college for the first time, you're away from home and you got all that freedom, and smoking and drinking becomes part of the social fabric. And I remember there was a cigarette machine on the floor of the dorm, and you put a quarter in there. 3 pennies came out with a pack of cigarettes and a book of matches. Now, those 3 pennies did me a big favor because when it came down the, down into the receiving end, it clang, 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 and seems like every dorm room had the super hearing, residence where once they hear that, they all come out to bum a cigarette off you. And after a month of having cigarettes, out of a whole pack of 20, I get like 3 or 4 out of it. I said, the heck with it. I'm not going to smoke. I'm not going to. That was the best thing that ever happened to me.
Well, most of the cigarette machines didn't work that way, Hank. Most of the cigarette machines, when you got your for anything from 1 to 4 cents change, it was pennies that were slipped into the cellophane that was sealing the pack.
Well, that came afterwards. So when the pennies came out loose, I said, I'm glad it made all those sounds and everyone kept me from smoking. Ah, well, listen. Hey, Joe, did you see what that story about last week, the big story about Amazon, the big elephant in the room, buying out Whole Foods for $13.7 billion?
That's with a B.
With a B, and I'm saying to myself, did they make a wise move?
Well, this depends on... there's a guy who's at the head of Amazon. His name is Bezos.
Yes, Jeff Bezos.
And... I got to tell you the truth.
He takes a lot of risk in everything.
He takes a lot of risk. But any day now, there's going to be a headline in the paper, the world's richest man, Jeff Bezos, because he takes risks, but they're not stupid risks. They're based on logic and on fact, and they're based upon usage. Now, people said to him when he first started setting up these huge warehouses that were totally automated, state-of-the-art warehouses, they said, you're selling books. What the hell are you going to do with all of that space? And he said, don't worry about it. It's going to be used. And he went out and he started not only selling on his catalog time other manufactured products, but he started fulfilling other manufacturers' products for them. And he said, if you advertise it on Amazon, we'll fulfill even the orders that didn't come in through Amazon. Yes, you'll pay for them, but we'll fulfill them. And he became America's largest fulfillment house. Then he went into another business. He was selling or distributing movies. Well, why shouldn't he produce some movies if he could distribute others? And he did that, and TV shows, and he wrote books and published. Now he wants to do it with groceries.
You know, but those are non-perishable items. When it comes to food, fish, fruits, and so on, there's a certain life to it, and if it's not sold, you're going to lose money on it. And I don't know about you, Joe. I don't buy that kind of food blindly. I go to a market that sells fish. I, you know, look under the gill. I look at the eyes of the fish. I even touch the fish. When it comes to fruits, I smell the fruit itself. You can't do that on online food selling that way.
That's absolutely true. Now, I do a lot of shopping on Amazon personally, but I do only what I would classify as non-foods. Yes, there are some foods.
You're talking about dry goods.
I guess they would be called dry goods, although some of them are wet, like a can of tuna fish. I'll buy a can.
That's a can. I mean, you still, you know.
I'll buy canned goods, yeah. And I'll buy dry goods, and I'll buy non-foods. But I'm not going to buy a melon over the phone. I want to smell that melon. I want to touch it. How he's going to work around that, I'm not really sure. But the other direction, he's already announced how he's going to do it. If you now buy something from Amazon, if you're a Prime customer, which now hits up to, I think, almost $100 a year. It used to be $60 a year. If you're a Prime customer, that Prime includes the shipping, and the shipping is 2 days shipping. So if you order it on Monday, you'll have it on Wednesday. But suppose you're not home on Wednesday. Then it's got to be redelivered the next day. Well, he has a thing, which they have right now, as he's been testing, where in different stores he has put, in essence, mailboxes, and he would send you the combination, and you could go get your stuff at the box. Suddenly, by doing this $13 billion sale, he's got 400 distribution centers all around America.
But Walmart has over 4,000.
Walmart wouldn't do the deal with him.
Oh, okay. By the way, you're talking about Amazon. I think they're doing something backwards now, okay? Because normally, if I go into Target or Costco or anything like that, and I see something and it looks attractive, I would take out the cell phone and, you know, I would say, okay, let me find out what it costs. I'll go to Amazon to see what the price is. And then I was shocked to see last week that Amazon was granted a patent where if you happen to be in a store and you want to check on prices on what other stores are selling that same item for, they can block it. So now, they don't have any brick-and-mortar stores to sell from, so why would they get this patent?
Except that now they have brick-and-mortar stores to sell from.
Well,
they got 400 of them, plus the new ones that they're opening up. I think there are two of them here in New York already.
Well, let me ask you, blocking it, do you think it's going to be effective? In other words,
I'm not even sure it's legal, Hank.
Well, the patent office has granted a patent, so if you say it's illegal, you're saying...
I'm telling you that I'm not really sure that the FCC will allow blocking of phone calls.
Well, I think they can because they say you happen to be in their store. They could do... Now, by the way, I've seen where you go to certain locations, you cannot get any signal at all.
I've seen that too. I do know that there's a ruling. I can't even talk about it because I'm so unsure of the facts, but there was some sort of a ruling banning that. I don't know the details. I can look them up and talk to you next week about it.
But it's quite interesting that because I'm trying to figure out how do you block it other than saying it may be treated as a fire ward, you recognize a certain DNS address or something like that. I don't know how they do it, but if you can block it, I guess the second question is it legal? And the third question is, how will people work around it? And that, you know what? People will find a way to work around it.
I can think of three ways right now.
Of working around it?
Absolutely.
Like?
Okay, I would open up a thing where you would text a number and a code to another number.
But then you need some. You need a.
You need a Wi-Fi connection.
You need, you need a person connection on the other end then, right?
Yes, that would be a business at the other end. Well, you wouldn't need a person. You'd need a computer.
Okay. And what's the other two methods?
The other two are based on sending an email to a human being who reads it and texts you back.
What's the third?
The third one is by sending your wife across the street to check
You see, I got something simpler than all three of that, okay?
What's that?
Step outside the store and then just do it.
Well, sometimes that's not so simple.
Why? Because now if I'm outside your store and you're blocking my signal.
You're talking about New York City?
Yes.
I'm thinking about Toronto where the stores are underground.
If it's underground, that means whether they block it or not, I can't get it then,
yeah.
Right? Now, by the way, that's not quite true because I know I've gone to a lot of malls now where you have a lot of major structures and so on. And I know that there's a mall where I live where every store is providing free Wi-Fi right outside their door.
Yes, I saw it.
And the more they do that.
I saw a couple of stores just here in Manhattan yesterday that have a big sign, free Wi-Fi, and then they gave you on that sign the name of the ID of the Wi-Fi and the password, so-and-so guest, so that if I wanted to, with their permission, I could lean up against the wall and do my email.
You don't have to lean against the wall because some of these signals are pretty strong.
Well, I can't go in and sit down
now,
and do it.
I'm looking at this patent that Amazon has, and I'm saying we're thinking the normal, but we're not thinking out of the box, okay? I just realized that Amazon could go to all these stores and say, I got a service to sell you to block your other people from, you know, if I go to, Bed Bath & Beyond or some of the stores there and I want to check a price, hey, Amazon could say, use our AWS service and we'll block out the signal for you.
But, you know, it's just a question, as I said before, of making new business. Anything that you might can come up with as a human being, somebody else will come up with as a human being.
You know, Joe, one of the things that we've been talking about is that can you ever eliminate brick and mortar because there's always, you know, the timeliness, like something that's perishable. But there's also, when you buy something, you want to be able to touch, feel, look at, have a sense of a feeling. Like, first of all, would you ever buy a car without ever driving the car first?
Oh, yes, I'd buy it without driving it, but not without kicking the tires.
You know, you laugh when I say that because I use that term, kicking the tires. Someone said to me, what do you mean kicking the tires?
It's an old-fashioned term.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, the last two cars I got, I went into the showroom knowing in advance what I wanted, and they still made me drive it.
Well, now, what's happening is that clothing, I could see where if the clothing doesn't fit, what happens is that you send it back and they'll give you another size and so on. But there is a need for stores, whether they're called retail stores or test stores and so on. And Best Buy is going to implement something called try before you buy option. And I read it very carefully. Try before you buy means you could take the product, try it out. If you like it, they'll sell you a new product. And I read it carefully. And basically, there's a small fee to do it. Isn't that really renting a product? If you like it, they'll sell it to you then?
A
new one?
In England, for years and years and years, at least since the 1960s, there's been a process called hire purchase. And what you do is you, in essence, rent the thing, but your a significant percentage of your rental fee goes towards the purchase price, and maybe a year or 2 years down the line, you get the bill of sale. It's cost you more than at retail, but it's a service. And if you want to, you can break the hire purchase agreement. So that goes without saying. What concerns me about things like this is there's going to be a large number of used items on the market.
No, but these used items are used for rental, and that if you want if you say I want to purchase it, what Best Buy said is you'll get the new product.
But what happens to the used one?
Oh, they continue to be used for other people who want to try it out.
And eventually it'll be sold to you for a fraction of the price.
Well, whoever wants to buy a used or refurb item.
Yeah.
And however, I think that's the way to go, because people do really want to see, you know, how something works before they really make a big commitment on a big purchase, okay?
Well, I had a weird experience at Best Buy a couple of weeks ago.
Weird? I've had many weird experiences.
You know, this was a nice weird experience.
Oh, okay.
I went in and bought a cable. I think it was around $15, $20. And they said, do I want to become a member of their whatever?
Prime?
Whatever it is that they call it.
Oh, wait. Prime is Amazon.
Amazon.
Right.
And I said, what does it cost? And they said, absolutely nothing. I said, yeah, I want to join. And they said, what's your phone number and what's your email address? And I gave it to them. And they said, and I said, well, what's my number? They said, well, you don't have to worry about it. Just use your name and address, and it'll show up in all of our computers worldwide. That was a couple of weeks ago. 2 days ago, there was in email a special sale, a terabyte portable drive for $40, $39.95.
That's a going price.
So I said, I could use one of those, and that's a pretty good price. So I went through the purchase routine online, and when the final purchase showed up, it said it was $5.25 less than it was supposed to be. And I said, that's weird. I went back and did it over again. Came out to the same price. So I bought it, but I called up Best Buy. And I said, what's the story? And they said, oh, well, you're a member of whatever the club is. And according to our computer, last week, or 2 weeks ago, you bought a cable. And this is the feedback on the cable, plus first-time users thing, blah, blah, blah. I got a coupon for like $5 for doing nothing.
Well, it's not for doing nothing. I mean, you bought something.
I bought something, but I might have bought it faster if they had told me this was going to be cheaper. I'm always amazed by people who give premiums after you've made a purchase anyway.
Well, you know, a lot of the retailers who are successful are starting to think outside the box now. In other words, it's not the normal conventional way. They're doing promoting things in a different way now, and I'm glad they're doing it, okay, because they were doing it the regular way, and, well, this is one way of jacking up business. Hey, Joe, you're talking about, you know, doing something different. Google Drive, you know what Google Drive is, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, how about you telling the audience what Google Drive is?
Google Drive is not a drive.
It's
not a drive.
Okay. It's a virtual drive. It's a cloud storage.
Google Drive is part of a massive storage farm someplace else in the world that Google is willing to either give you a piece of or rent you a piece of or a combination of both give and rent. They've changed the terms fairly frequently on what you get free. But
when you say changing the terms, you're talking about pricing terms, not a description.
No. It started off being, I believe it was unlimited at one time.
It was, and then, of course, when you get people abusing it and using up a terabyte or more. And what it is that the Google Drive, I know that on your email, if you're using Gmail, I think you get 15 gigabytes.
Yes, now
and
you do.
Which is pretty decent because it's mostly text that people use. And what now they have is that there's a Google app that you can use on your PC called Backup and Sync. That sounds like it's a backup program.
It does. It sounds like it's a backup program. But more than that, it's a backup program, which is a continuous backup program, not just a one-shot.
Except that you don't know whether there's a retention on it, how long to keep it. And, of course, our most famous question that we ask is, with the cloud storage, does the NSA have access to it?
Well, the answer to your last question is yes.
Always. Unfortunately.
The answer to your first question is you can find out.
I don't want to find out. But, Joe, on the Google Drive, you say, all right, suppose I need more than 15 gigabytes. Well, there's from 15 to 100 gigabytes, there's a minor charge of $1.99 a month. Basically, it's $2 a month or $24 a year for 100 gigabytes. That's pretty expensive for 100 gigabytes.
It was very reasonable several years ago, and it's terribly expensive today.
Well, now, if you want 1 terabyte, which is what was originally it was for free, they want $10 a month. That's $120.
And I just bought a terabyte drive for $35 and change.
Well, but the thing is, that's not cloud storage, right?
Well, it certainly is because I'm going to keep it in your house.
No. Well, number one is that if you have a local drive, that's you cannot call that cloud storage. So the disadvantage of that is you're safe. Oh, wait a minute. Did I use a double negative? The disadvantage of that is you're safe? By the way, I said that in jest, okay?
You did say it in jest, and I was halfway serious by saying I will make my own personal private cloud by keeping it in your basement.
Well, then you brought up a point to me, and I said, wait a minute, Joe, are you kidding me? Is that this system of how much storage you need, we need more than 1 terabyte, can be up to $1,800 a year, something like that?
Well,
I couldn't believe that.
Well, look at how much 1 terabyte cost.
$120 a year.
Now, divide that into 1,800, and you'll see how many terabytes you get.
Now, wait a minute.
What it is that you get 30 terabytes.
Well, okay, but the thing is, you don't put pictures up there because I just put it on an external drive, okay? The kind of data that you really want to use for cloud storage is dynamic data, not static data. Dynamic data is constantly changing, constantly needs to be backed up. But on static data, hey, just put it away.
Well, Hank, back in the day, a company called Eastman Kodak.
Oh, yeah. They had unlimited storage on all your pictures.
On all your pictures. Unlimited storage. Color pictures, black and white pictures, negatives, positives, whatever you wanted. As long as it was digitized, it was stored there free.
And they never increased the cost or had a cost to it except for one thing. They said, oh, by the way, we're closing up the business. You got, how many days to get it off? And people panic like crazy.
I think the first announcement was 30 days. The final announcement was 1 week. And people said, what am I going to do? I mean, I've got 30 terabytes of storage up there.
Just remember, anyone who uses cloud storage, there's two things to remember. One is it is not what you would call absolutely secure, safe storage. I don't care what anyone says. And the second is the rates can change up, down, and if you really want to be able to control your own destiny in terms of your own storage, maintain your own external storage and maintain your own backup. And that's the way I would do it, okay? Hey, Joe, in our second half hour, we have a couple of very interesting segments. Dr. Alfred Poor, in his wearable and health technology segment, has three interesting subjects that he's going to talk about. One is a new system to help people navigate, blind people to navigate. That's quite interesting. And I wish I knew about this a long time ago. There's a new technology for how pacemakers are being used. But one of the things that he does talk about is that there's a serious risk of for health people falling who are 65 and older. That is a big, big subject. I didn't realize that 20 to 25% of seniors 65 and older are at risk, and when they fall, they suffer some serious health, ill health.
Broken hips just being one of many problems you could face.
And I have a segment where I call it, they are product reviews, and they are product reviews. You'll find that interesting. And Marty Winston on home automation, he talks about the electric grid on something that was reported on just in the past week or two. Security firms ESET and Dragos revealed that there's a piece of malware called Crash Override, and fortunately they found it hitting the electric grid. So let's get to it right away.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider. This week, I've got three very different stories for you. I've got one about a new system that will help the blind navigate within a room. I've also got a new technology for pacemakers. But I'm going to start off talking about falling. Most of us can stumble and fall when we're walking up the stairs or something. But once you're over 65, falling becomes a serious risk. In just the year 2000, in the United States, seniors who were 65 or older fell and required medical treatment more than 2.6 million times. 2.6 million times they had falls that required medical treatment. And the total price tag for all of this was about $19 billion. That's B with a big B, billion. And that's just for the direct medical costs. That doesn't include loss of productivity or other kinds of expenses. In these incidents, only about a third of them involved a broken bone, and yet those broken bone incidents accounted for a full 60% of all the expenses. So we're looking at a major medical cost here, and if we could find ways to reduce the number of falls that seniors experience and reduce the number of injuries that result from them, we could save an awful lot of money, and we could also have much better lives for the seniors. The problem is it's difficult to predict who's at risk. It requires equipment that tends to be expensive, and it requires trained people to assess the senior to figure out their risk of fall. Researchers from the Burke Medical Research Institute in White Plains, New York, they've come up with a less costly way to evaluate a person for their risk of falling. What they did was they had the subjects in a seated position, not even standing. They were seated on a force plate, something that measures the different forces at different points of their body. And this is a standard procedure used for evaluating a subject's risk of falling and assessing their balance and so forth. What they did was, at the same time that they underwent these tests in a seated position, they also had a standard Microsoft Kinect 2 scanner set up in the room. This is one of those game devices that allows you to dance around in front of the screen, and the Xbox gaming console can then see your movements, and you can actually use your body as the controller for video games. So it's a low-cost device, and it actually sees in three dimensions using invisible infrared light. What they were able to do was measure the motions of the subjects as they were seated on the force plate, and they discovered that the measurements from the Kinect 2 scanner correlated really well with the data from the traditional force plate measurements. Basically, they had the subject sit with both feet on the floor and then raise one leg and then raise both legs. The results from the Kinect were as good as the results from the force plate for predicting their stability. The cool thing about this, since it's low cost, is it means that screenings can be done by more people with less training in more places, such as senior centers and doctor's offices and so forth. But it could even be installed in the home and could be used as part of a telehealth program and a way of monitoring seniors who might be undergoing gradual impairment. And so this could be a way to track their impairment and be more aware of their increased risk of falling. If they reach a certain increased risk of falling, then different measures could be taken to prevent them from falling, adding a cane, adding a walker, making some other adjustments in their life. This could make their lives much happier and save an enormous amount of healthcare costs at the same time. For centuries, perhaps eons, blind people have relied on a very simple technology to find their way around in a space without running into things, and that's using a stick. They just wave the stick around, and if it hits something, then they know not to walk into it. Now the sticks have evolved, and we now have the familiar long cane that a lot of people with limited vision use to help navigate and find their way around. But it really hasn't changed a whole lot from the basic stick concept. We're constantly looking for new ways to improve navigation for people with limited vision or total blindness. Researchers at MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Lab, CSAIL, have actually come up with a system that's pretty slick and could have a lot of valuable applications for people to improve their ability to get around. A lot of systems rely on sound cues for the wearer, but the problem with that is if you're listening to the sounds, then that cuts you off from the sounds in your environment. And so what this device does is when it wants to convey information to the wearer, it actually relies on a belt that has haptic devices. In other words, little modules that can vibrate. So when the person is standing there, the belt will vibrate in different locations, giving them a nudge to move in this direction or turn that way or whatever it is they want. In addition to that, it has a little braille pad, a dynamic braille pad that they can touch, and it can spell things out for them. Now, what is the information that it's conveying? Well, the information comes from a 3D camera that they wear on their chest. And this camera can look around the room, but not only does it detect obstacles and things that might get in the way of the person walking, it is also able to use artificial intelligence to dynamically identify objects within the space. It might see an object that it identifies as a table. On that braille pad, it will put up a code so that the person knows that the object that they're getting a sense of is a table. The cool thing is it can also identify a chair. Not only can it identify a chair, but it can also tell whether it's occupied or not. So when a blind person walks into a room and is looking to find a seat, this way they can find an empty chair on their own and not inadvertently try to sit down in somebody else's lap. The system not only detects the presence of objects, but also conveys information about them, which could be really good. Now, this initial prototype device that they've been working with is rather bulky, but it could very easily be miniaturized and made much smaller and much more convenient and probably fairly inobtrusive. It's designed so that it can be used on its own or with a standard cane. They found that the system helps people with limited vision reduce the number of collisions that they have with either cane collisions or walking into bystanders by like up to 80%. So it's a very powerful system and could make a very positive change in a lot of people's lives. My third story this week is about pacemakers. Now, pacemakers have saved hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, maybe more, of lives over the years. Basically, what they do is when the heart goes out of rhythm, the pacemaker is able to provide an electrical jolt that will turn the heart back to a normal rhythm and prevent a heart attack or other problems. It was originally invented back in the 1950s. The person who invented it was actually trying to create a device to record the sounds of a working heart, but inadvertently, the recording device kept shocking the heart, and that's how they realized that there was an opportunity to have an implant to help regulate the heartbeats. The big problem is that in order to create the shock, you need power, you need electricity. And in order to have electricity, that typically means that you need a battery. And today, the typical pacemaker relies on a battery that's implanted in the body along with the device. And it lasts for years, but it doesn't last indefinitely. So every 3 to 5 years, you need to have a somewhat invasive procedure to go in, take out the pacemaker, and replace the battery. It would be wonderful if you didn't have to go through that invasive procedure to change out the battery. And in fact, that's exactly what this new design has in mind. Instead of having a battery, it uses a capacitor to store the electrical energy that it needs in order to operate. The problem then is, how do you get the power to the capacitor? Well, instead of running it with wires from outside the body, which would create additional complications, what they've been able to do, they can use a wireless transmitter that will transmit microwaves. You put the transmitter outside the body near the pacemaker's location, and the wireless transmitter will use the microwaves to send energy into the device where it can charge up that capacitor and recharge it very quickly so that it's ready to operate. The external battery and transmitter could be carried in a shirt pocket, or it could be worn on a chest strap. The idea is that it doesn't need any leads in the device to connect to a power source, which minimizes the number of connections in the device, makes it more reliable, and again, eliminates the need for surgery to change the battery every few years. The device has already been successfully demonstrated using a pig, and further studies under development. Hopefully this new approach will be available for human trials before too long. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. Synchrony Financial had a consumer study of electronics industry confirmed that the consumer behavior is changing in the purchase of electronics equipment. They used the full year 2016 in their study, and here are some of the important things that came out of the study. 88% of major purchase of electronics equipment said they began their shopping online first. In other words, they want to know a little more about the product, the description, and the features and specifications. 70% said that they consulted with friends and family and before making the purchase. 54% said that they checked online reviews. 53% did some more research in the store itself. 41% said that they research financing plans. When it comes to electronics equipment and you're buying a big ticket item, if you need it for a business, you buy it. But if you don't really need it, but you just like to have it, wait until you have the money, because the price will come down, you get more features. 69% said that they chose a payment plan first before buying. But the big surprise was that 63% said that they made a big electronic purchase in the store itself. I thought it would be online, but I guess it's not. The findings themselves are really somewhat surprising on how people go about buying major electronic equipment. Increasingly, consumers are doing online research for financing plans as part of their shopping process. The study revealed that 41% of electronic consumers exploring payment plans before making the purchase. That's up from 34% a year ago. Well, if you're going to be buying a big ticket item, just to recap, most people begin by researching online. Many consult social media for reviews or advice. That's a major change. But you have to be careful of the reviews that you get and the advice you get. But you have to be careful of fake reviews online and especially in social media. It does not come as a surprise that some manufacturers make up some of these reviews and they go on social media to give themselves a very favorable mention, as well as to knock a competitor's product. More than half of the people have checked out the products in a local store. That's good. You want to be able to look at the product, look at the specifications, and that it's a functional product that meets your need. Most people, when they buy a car, would drive the car first. Unfortunately, in electronics, many people buy electronics equipment without ever having seen the product. Now, I realize that some of the big ticket items are just not available in the store, but you should make every effort to find something that is the equivalent of it from the same manufacturer or something very close to it. If not, I would hesitate buying it because you're buying something blind. Some of the features that are more apparent when you're there to see it could be a red flag that you would say, I'm not going to buy that because this is what I see. Others would say, I just need it, I'll just buy it. The big surprise, of course, is that nearly two-thirds will buy the item in a physical store. So this bit about brick and mortar is disappearing. It may be in the retail area. Amazon has put many of the retail stores in jeopardy. Many of them are closing up or in the process of closing up. Macy's cut down the number of stores. Sears Roebuck is closing down by the end of the year. There are other major retailers that are just closing and looking for someone to buy them out. In those cases, those are items which are pretty much, you know what they are. You like something, it either fits or doesn't fit. And when you go online, if it doesn't fit, you can ship it back. But when it comes to electronics, it's not a question of whether it fits or not. It's a question of, is it functionally something that meets your needs? You may find that it meets all the specifications, but if you can't see the screen when you're in, when you're in the store and you can't see the screen in a legible way, you're going to shy away from it. How would you know that just by going online and shopping? Well, just that when you go online and you're doing shopping for electronics equipment, beware of fake reviews. And now, Marty Winston with a presentation on the electric grid.
You know, this segment actually has nothing to do with my usual 40-year cyber house theme. That's 40yearhouse.com if you want to go look. Boy, do I owe that an update on the writing. A lot coming, guys. A lot coming. This is more about Hank's favorite mantra, backup, backup, backup. And a brand new reason for doing that. I don't know if you've caught this on the news. If you have, I'm not sure you looked into it. But I first saw it on national TV news a week ago. I spent some time looking into it. It's a pair of descriptions for the same exploit called either Industroyer, like industry with Oyer at the end, Industroyer, or Crash Override. In both cases, it's a way for hackers to take down the power grid, or little chunks of it at a time. What they're doing, and by the way, they were just, to give credit where it's due, ESET, the anti-malware publisher, calls it Industroyer, and they did an announcement about it. Dragos, which is a consulting firm, calls it Crash Override. We're talking about the very same thing. This is about bad guys getting into the controls at power plants to shut down chunks of the power grid remotely. Okay? Now, you may know that we're dealing with circuit breakers that are designed to be remote controlled. They're at locations that power companies equip specifically for remote operation, which lets them save money by staffing command centers instead of all of their field stations. So if a hacker does manage to take control, it'll only last until they can get somebody out there to operate the manual overrides, which is, you know, probably not going to be more than a few hours, maybe a chunk of a day in the worst case. So it's not going to make us go back to the Stone Age, but it is going to make us think, what is happening here? Here's what the exploit is. It's a software loop. It's a software loop that prevents an open circuit breaker from closing. Now, open and closed. It takes a circuit breaker that's turned off and stops it from being able to turn on. That's what we're talking about, and it does it with a software loop. So what is so hard about that? Well, apparently not enough. There is no second factor authentication in most of these remote controls. There is simply something like a managed switch that you deal with in networking all the time. So a hacker figures out the address of the circuit breaker. Next thing you know, they decide they're going to take out a chunk of your state. Bang, lights go dark. Alarms go off. Somebody gets dispatched. They go off, and they try to fix it. So Crash Override or Industroyer are the bad guys getting control of these little power stations all over the map. Now, utilities could put in second-factor authentication. It's available. Is there an expense? Yeah. What's more expensive, that or having a whole bunch of us really upset with them because they don't? You know, there's customers and there's regulators and all kinds of stuff. I think they're going to feel compelled to do the right thing about it. I have to say that it's been exposed. It's out there. So people should not be surprised by it. Now, I talked to my friends at CyberPower, and I said, guys, you know, you got this gigantic national news exploit out there that can shut down major portions of the grid. What does that do for your uninterruptible power systems? I asked them, you know, what's going to change? What do people need to do? And what they said, nothing different. The UPS, the CyberPower, anybody else, a UPS that you get and use today doesn't care why the power went away. It just stepped a soft landing instead of a crash landing. What was it that Hank said? Backup, backup still goes. See you later.
Thank you, Marty. Just to remind everyone, on Wednesday, July 12th, we will have a special broadcast on the convergence of technology with health issues. On that date in 1957, the U.S. Surgeon General Leroy Burney linked smoking with lung cancer. Public service announcements of regional computer club meetings in this area. The Princeton PC Users Group will be meeting on Tuesday, June the 27th, in the community room of the Princeton Public Library in Princeton, New Jersey. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will be meeting on Thursday, June the 29th at 6:45 p.m. and the topic of presentation is Tuning Up Your Windows PC, Middletown Library, Large Community Room in Middletown, New Jersey. The Westchester PC Users Group will be having a presentation on Create Stunning Photos Like a Pro, Using Your Mobile Device with Free Apps, Thursday, July 6th at 7 p.m., Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road, room number 101, White Plains, New York. The Danbury Area Computer Society will have a presentation on using the iPad with a person living with dementia. Tuesday, July 11th, 7:30 p.m. at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. Rockland PC Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, July 11th, 2017 at 7:15 p.m. Rassel Room on the fourth floor of the Palisades Moor in West Nyack. The New York Amateur Computer Club will be meeting on Thursday, July 13th, 7 p.m. at NYU in the Silver Building, Room 411, 31 Washington Place in Manhattan, New York. If you have a computer club meeting I might not have mentioned, just send me a notification with date, time, place, and subject if possible to hank@pcradioshow.org. With all of these club meetings, it's open to the public and free of charge, and they hope to be seeing you there. The Eclipse Mega Movie Project. It is for August the 21st. Join in the first of a kind citizen science project gathering scientifically valuable data from the total solar eclipse that will traverse North America. The project will gather images of the 2017 total solar eclipse from over 1,000 volunteer photographers and amateur astronomers, as well as many more members of the general public. The project then will stitch all these pictures together to create an expanded and continuous view of the total eclipse as it crosses the United States. If you want to participate in this particular project with your pictures, you can go to eclipsemega.movie. The website for the Personal Computer Show is pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at pcradio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, on the Internet, and 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, or WBAI.org, streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and always back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and stay cool until we meet again. Same time, same station next week.